Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
My name is Kevin Casasamora. I'm the Secretary General of International Idea, and it is my joy and my honor to welcome a very special guest. We're going to have a conversation today with Mr. Martin Wolf. Martin hardly needs an introduction. He's the chief economics commentator at the Financial Times, and he's one of the most respected journalists and analysts on global affairs in the world, with his columns read eagerly by policymakers and the public all over the world. He was awarded the Commander of the British Empire in 2000 for services to financial journalism. And he just published a very important book called The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism. This is a continuation of a long line of books that he's written about global affairs, which I've been fortunate to read over the years and enjoy. So for me, it is a real joy to have you here, Martin. So welcome to our podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So Martin, let's dive into the substance right away, and perhaps the easiest way to do it is simply by asking you to summarize the thrust of the argument of the book, and give us give the audience a good reason to read the book. So let's start by doing just that.
Okay, well, let me summarize this rather large book in the following way. Over the last 20 years or so, perhaps slightly less, we have been witnessing what Larry Diamond at Stanford, a great scholar in this area, calls a democratic recession, a decline in the quality of democracy, a shift towards autocracy in many parts of the world, but notably including the advanced countries, so-called advanced countries, the high-income democracies, where democracy was believed to be fully consolidated, fully established. And this includes some pretty important democracies like the United States. But also, I think we can see this in many European countries, including the United Kingdom. And of course, in many other parts of the world, this same tendency is noticed. I can refer to countries like Turkey or even India in this category. Brazil could be mentioned. So the question I address is, what's going on? Why has this happened? And why has it particularly been happening in a place like the US or UK? What explains the rise of demagogic populism, which often has a right-wing autocratic characteristic pretty well everywhere? There are very few exceptions to this where this is happening. And that's the question the book addresses. And to do so, it asks first, what is the connection between capitalism and democracy? It argues they are complementary opposites. They are mutually supportive, but the relationship, the marriage, as I call it, is very, very fragile. And it can be destroyed by, at its most fundamental, a breakdown in trust between large parts of the people and ruling elites, both in business and in politics. And such a breakdown in trust, I argue, has occurred in very substantial measure, though not entirely, because of economic transformations, which are partly the result of inevitable and powerful forces of technology, the rise of China. All these are things that I don't think could have easily been altered, but also because of profound policy mistakes and political mistakes which have allowed the emergence of a rentier form of capitalism, an exploitative form of capitalism. Globalization is not at the heart of this, but there it is linked with it in some way. And this came to a head, if you like, particularly in these Western countries, with the financial crisis, which undermined confidence profoundly and has led to a really very virulent backlash, which you can see in the election of Trump as president and his still role in American politics and in Brexit and things of this kind. And so what I do is explain the link between capitalism and democracy, why it's fragile, why it's breaking down, and then a fairly lengthy analysis of some of the things that, in my view, have to be done to bring it back together again. And that, I suppose, is the briefest possible summary I can give you of my book.
One of the things that I noticed in the book is that in a very explicit way, and in a very well-argued way, I should say, you make the claim that the fate of democracy, of liberal democracy and capitalism, is intertwined. That they, as it were, they rise and fall together. What if this is not true? Because, after all, this is the wager that China and others, one can think of Singapore perhaps and other places, are making, that you can actually have capitalist prosperity without political liberalization. What do you say to that?
I think this is a very important issue, which of course I address. I make two quite different sorts of observations, one more broader and one more specific. The broader one is, what if you were benevolent autocracies, that is states which have total power, and nevertheless allow the competitive dynamic forces of capitalism free reign and give people enough freedom and predictability to support it, are really quite rare. And so the first point to make is that if you look across the universe of autocratic regimes, almost by definition, they're very, very high variance regimes with a very strong tendency to a very long tail of appalling regimes. And the reason is there are no checks and balances, by definition. You're entirely dependent on the good sense, decency, and restraint of top leaders or a top leader. There's nothing in the system that countervails autocracy. And the result is most autocracies, including some of the ones, including, say, China under Mao, have committed egregious crimes and have done absolutely nothing for the economic development of their societies. That's the norm. So the first point is autocracy is a very high-risk system for this reason. And the second is, if you look at these examples, you can see why they're so fragile. And I think what's happening in China now shows it. Singapore, I think, is genuinely sui generis. And the reason for it is not really the exceptional quality of the leadership, though it has been exceptional. It is that it is a very small, very open economy, and all the capitalists that matter in Singapore are foreign. That's simply true. The people who created most of the wealth are foreign capitalists who've come in to enjoy the rule of law, the fine infrastructure, the fine education that Singaporeans provide. This means that for Singapore to succeed, it has to provide an extremely predictable, law-governed environment, which will attract businesses from all over the world, and they could all leave tomorrow. And that's an incredibly powerful constraint. And because Singapore is so small and so open, I think this provides a check, if you like, on the policymakers, which is pretty well as effective as democracy. China is very, very different. because, of course, China is not at all small, and by world standards, it's no longer particularly open. The problem in China is that under an exceptionally intelligent man, Deng Xiaoping, who also had this weird characteristic for someone who got to the top of a system like that, I think by accident, that he didn't really want power. What is so interesting about Deng is he basically said, you go ahead and run it. I'll just sit in the background and play bridge, which he was very good at. And I'll just oversee it, and I'll enter when there's an emergency, but you get on with it. Now, that wasn't true of Mao, and it certainly isn't true of Xi. And that has consequences, because what he's seeing, and this links with the other great weakness of China, if you have a bustling hubbub of capitalism operating dynamically, as it certainly did, in a society without the rule of law, where every resource you need is dependent on the permission of bureaucrats, land, anything like that, you need their permission, inevitably this becomes corrupt. It's because there's no constraint on it, there's no legal structure. And Xi got very, very nervous about the corruption. He thought that this was undermining the legitimacy of the Communist Party. He's quite explicit about this. It's not something hidden. So he said, I'm going to crack down on corruption massively. But in the process of doing so, he frightened bureaucrats into not doing very much, and he frightened capitalists into not doing very much. And there's no doubt at all, if you look at the figures carefully, that Chinese growth is slowing very, very rapidly. And there are big economic problems that they can't solve. So I believe, could prove to be wrong, but I think 20 years from now, people will look back and see that that capitalist interlude, 30, 40 years of enormous success, was an exception. It didn't last because the regime is fundamentally at odds with the system of law and of accountability that only democratic capitalism can provide. So they are both interesting examples, but for these reasons, and the fact that I prefer living in a country of this kind, and I believe most other people do, that democracy's marriage with capitalism is the best available system.
Martin, inequality is very much at the heart of the story you tell. And inequality in particular is at the heart of the dysfunction that has come to plague democracy pretty much everywhere. And you make a very interesting and persuasive argument that at this point, all things considered, is the reasons for this already obscene levels of inequality to continue to grow and grow are essentially political, that the political system is captured, essentially. And this is an argument that, you know, different versions of this argument has been made by Paul Krugman and others. And in the process of making that argument, one of the things that I notice is that you don't talk too much about globalization as a source of inequality. And I got the sense that to some extent, globalization and free trade were left a bit off the hook when it comes to inequality. I would like you to tell us a bit about this. And I'll tell you, you know, why I'm particularly interested in this, because I get the sense, you know, I'm a free trader by conviction, and I'm a fan of globalization, and I'm convinced that more people have gained from globalization than have lost. But perhaps we were too oblivious to the fact that there were a hell of a lot of losers from globalization. And perhaps we didn't pay enough attention to that. So talk us through the causes of inequality and the role of globalization in all of this.
So I think now there is one aspect of it I should have paid more attention to, but the book was already very long. And the aspect that I paid insufficient attention to, which didn't mean that I didn't pay attention to it, was financial globalization. But most people, and it's already, I think, implicit in the way you've framed the question, though I may be wrong, are really referring to globalization on the trade side, and particularly the trade in goods side. And I do cite, and I believe it's absolutely clear and true, that the role of trade in goods in particular, the rise of China, in explaining the rise of inequality within developed countries is wildly exaggerated. And I think it's wildly exaggerated because it's so much easier to blame foreigners for things that really were going internally. And let me just make a few points about this. The first, and it really is a very important point, the rise in inequality, and I'll just focus here on the high-income countries because that's predominantly what the book is about, is far from universal. It's very, very uneven, this rise, and it's particularly severe in the US. As soon as you know that, you will have to start wondering, can the globalization of trade be a dominant cause of rising inequality? Because among the developed countries, the US is far and away the least open to trade. It is, and the difference is massive. And the and there are countries, particularly in Europe, smaller countries, which are enormously open to trade and buffeted by exactly the same process as the US, where the rise in inequality we see basically didn't happen. You look at a country like Denmark or Sweden or even Germany. So it's very, very difficult to look at this and then say, well, it must be trade, when the country most affected by this is in fact the country least affected by trade. The second point is the rise in inequality has been a consistent process and has two elements, a hollowing out of the middle and enormous accretion of wealth at the very top. Those are the dominant features of this rise in inequality, so one has to be careful about it. This has occurred and consistently over a period of three or four decades, but the huge rise in imports, which affected manufacturing in the US so strongly, was basically in the first 10, 12 years of this century. And the so-called China shock, as it's been called. And so they don't fit together. Yes, there's no question in that period and that period alone, there was a very rapid deindustrialization of the labor force, a decline in the share of the labor force in manufacturing. But it wasn't true of the rest of the time. And by the way, in terms of absolute numbers, we're talking really about quite a small proportion of the US labor force. So there's lots more evidence on this, but that's the core of it. So the question then is, what did cause this rise in inequality? And it seems to me that far more important were technological changes, which were general, which you had to fight against. That's pretty clear. Skill bias, technical change in particular, and the rise in productivity in manufacturing in particular, which shifted people out of manufacturing employment basically everywhere. But more important was a dramatic shift in corporate governance, what is called the financialization of the company, the decline in the security of the labor force in that context, and the dominant role of profit-seeking in companies and in the economy as a whole through the growth of the financial sector in, as I put it, extracting rent of various kinds. And I think these are far more important sources of the extraordinary inequality which we see in the US. And it's not an accident. The UK, which has the most important financial sector in the Western Europe, is also the other country that had a huge increase in inequality under Margaret Thatcher, which wasn't so much linked with globalization. It was linked with these other forces, in my view. So I think we blame trade because it's convenient to blame foreigners rather than powerful people in our own country. Where I do think there is a genuine argument, where I don't think I was clear enough, though I think there's far more in the broader aspects of monopolization and financialization that is at work, is the fact that as part of globalization, it was very easy for firms to move their businesses abroad. And that's a very specific aspect of the globalization of capital. I don't analyze that, I think, to the extent I probably should have done. And I'm not quite clear what can be done about it, except, and this is quite an important thing, that we need to look at the tax system very carefully, because it's one of the reasons for this capital flight. But I think the evidence is really quite clear that trade has not been the dominant source of the rising inequality in those developed countries most affected by rising inequality. Other forces were more relevant, and the reason we don't focus upon them is that we then have to look at the way the financial sector works, the way companies are governed, and the way technology is applied, and the competition or loss of competition that technology has created. And these are, I think, the much deeper forces at work.
One of the things that you spend quite a significant part of the book talking about is the propensity of the current economic structures to generate rent-seeking, and how this has become one of the reasons for the dysfunction in the political system and also in the workings of the economy. And upon reading that, I couldn't help but to be terrified by the thought that, well, you know, we had this thought, you know, I come from Latin America, and we had this thought that, well, Latin America eventually could become like an advanced democracy, and, you know, Latin American countries could become advanced capitalist economies. And upon reading the book, the thought assaulted me that perhaps it's the other way around, and that the rest of the world is becoming more like Latin America, which, if you ask me, is a terrifying thought, because that's exactly the kind of thing that is pervasive in Latin America, is rent-seeking, is the perpetuation of inequality through the workings of the political system. Can you care to comment a little bit about this?
Yes, I agree completely. My sense would be that indeed there are sort of been three characteristics. By and large, economies have not been very dynamic or not consistently dynamic and innovative. This is partly related to institutional and political failures. A lot of those failures are the product of class structure and plutocratic extractive tendencies that, as Acemoglu and Robinson have tended to argue, the predatory colonial regime, as it were, was translated into the liberated Latin America in the 19th and 20th centuries. And then you have an oscillation in politics between predatory oligarchic regimes and predatory autocratic populist regimes, neither of which are interested in establishing functioning institutions that prioritize the welfare of the people as a whole, and above all, neither of which are interested in the constraints that such a regime would entail upon them. Well, when I look at America now, it seems to me Trump is a sort of pretty standard Latin American caudillo. His regime is as empty in terms of policy, but as full of performative politics as many we have seen from afar, in my case, in Latin America. The regime may be different, but Trump and Obrador seem to me rather similar sorts of people. You can correct me, of course. I'm not an expert here. And the danger then is you get into what I think of as a populist cycle, between right-wing autocrats who don't manage to retain power forever. Sometimes they hold it for a long time. They're removed, but they leave such a ruin that it's almost impossible to recover it in a reasonable time. And often they're then replaced by left-wing populists who are equally ineffective. So it does seem to me that a worry is that that is where our politics may go. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me it is the best warning we have of what happens in highly unequal societies where the rent-extracting minority is determined to retain their position in a democracy, in some sort of democracy. It's basically they corrupt politics. And they corrupt politics by using their wealth to extract political power. And of course, sometimes they even use the Trump-like demagogue as part of the regime. So oligarchy and autocracy sort of go together to some extent. And that, I think, is exactly what we are seeing. And this perception that that's what happened in this very important continent has undoubtedly influenced my way of thinking about what is happening in some of our countries.
Well, there's an argument to be made that authoritarian populism is a Latin American invention. So I think there's a column there, Martin, if you allow me.
I would say, well, it's a question of the invention. I mean, to my mind, Napoleon III was another example of exactly that, an authoritarian populist, but he could dress himself, of course, in the clothes of his great uncle. So I would say it's a general phenomenon in regimes that are becoming more democratic, where the people have a say, but are not well enough informed yet and not trusted enough to form institutions, political parties and so forth that absolutely function. But certainly it's more prevalent, without a doubt, in South America than elsewhere.
Exactly.
I mean, in many Asian societies, by no means all, this respect for bureaucratic competence is a very deeply established historical phenomenon. And it is, I think, a bit of a help.
Perhaps my point is that this phenomenon of authoritarian populism that a lot of the world seems to be smarting up to has been for the longest time, has been part of the political landscape in Latin America. I mean, populism has been perfected as an art in Latin America. Anyway, very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the reform agenda. You devote a lot of pages to an updated reform program based on five key tenets originally developed as part of the New Deal. Talk us through the reform agenda.
Well, let me first put what I think is the overarching political context, which many people might well feel is sort of nostalgic and even reactionary, but it is the way I came to think about it. And it brought me back in a way to where I was 30 or 40 years ago. So looking at what has happened and looking at what has worked in a democratic context, it seems to me that we have to move back, and there are other authors who've made the same argument. Pranab Bardhan, in an excellent book, has also made this argument, in what I would call a social democratic direction. That is to say, a society in which the market plays a central role, and I include FDR's New Deal in that very broad context, but in which the responsibility of an active state for the provision of public goods, for ensuring a reasonable degree of equality, ensuring that everybody has decent life chances wherever they start. A sense, in other words, that society as a whole matters, which I think is the best expression in contemporary circumstances of what seems to me the core concept in a democracy, which is citizenship. This is why I use the word citizenship as the sort of motivating idea. Now, once you start asking that, you know, approaching it in that way, you find yourself having to think about Well, what would social democracy mean now? How would you reestablish it? Now, we have a few social democratic societies that work reasonably well, but they have problems, for sure. But that's really what I'm trying to do. So I want a government that provides adequate security, because there are so many aspects of economic life that cannot be insured by the market, will not be insured by the market. We know that. So we need proper safety nets. And in America in particular, and to a significant extent in Britain too, they don't really exist anymore. We need, that means helping children, making sure that you have the proper education. It means universal health. It means, but it also means, in this way, I go some way with the Biden administration, a more active government in promoting innovation, and as part of it, and indeed some aspects of industrial policy to generate the growth that we're not seeing, or at least help generate the growth we're seeing. It means an active competition policy, very, very important in post-war Germany, that's crucial. It means a reduction in the massive incentives for the growth of finance. It means reconsidering corporate governance. I've opened that discussion up, though there are many possibilities there because of the power concentrations. It means removing the role of money from politics as far as you possibly can. It means international agreement on minimum taxes. We need to go much further to ensure that every country can tax the income that is being generated in it, particularly by the rich, who are now effectively almost completely untaxed, which is very little understood. It's a comprehensive agenda to bring the notion of citizenship to life. And of course, this includes at the center of the idea that in the end, we are, of course, part of a global civilization, and that must be protected. And this is one of the other great contradictions of our age. But we are all rooted in, or nearly all of us are rooted in our sense of being part of a nation, of a country, of a political system. And without that sense of participation, I don't think democracy can function. So that's the overarching principle. And the hope is that people will feel they have dignity, that they are being listened to, that they have a voice, that the society in some profound way is theirs. And that's what we're trying to do. Can this be done? You might ask, you probably will. Well, the answer to that is I really don't know. But I'm really sure of, is if we don't manage that, the populist demagogues will win.
Well, you put forward this very ambitious reform program, which is not revolutionary, and you're very explicit about this, but is a series of pieces of very ambitious piecemeal social engineering. So one obvious question for this ambitious program is, who's the agent of this? Towards the very, very end of the book, you spend a couple of pages pinning your hopes really on the on enlightened elites. Why should we pin our hopes there? Who is the agent of this?
Okay, this is a very good question. I have a few observations. The first, it's pretty clear that the great transformations of the 20th century in our societies in this direction were driven, I think, by three things. One of which I don't see, and one of which I don't want to repeat, and then we'll end up with the elites. One was the organization and mobilization of the working class, and parts of the middle class, but the political engagement, and actually the fascinating sort of, in particular in countries like this and in America, the alliance between the organized working class and important parts of the intelligentsia. in centre-left parties like the Labour Party, the Democrats, and you see this in the Social Democrats in Sweden. So this is all part of that. And it is clearly a very important fact that, to my mind, largely because of economic change, but not only, that the organized working class has been atomized and disenchanted, and a lot of them have thus moved to be right-wing supporters of right-wing populists. I mean, that's a very big and important shift. And it would be very helpful if we could reverse this to some significant degree. But I don't know whether it's possible, and I don't know how we do it. But I have come to the view that it is really important, and I don't think I say enough of it there, but for a stronger working class to emerge, however much we may dislike it, because it has a political function as well as a social function. The second thing that made it happen, which I certainly don't want to see repeated, is war. There is no doubt, I think I touch on this in various stages, but I don't say enough, that the great wars forced societies to start recognize the contribution of everybody. These were universal conscript war, or at least universal male conscript war, and that forced people to take account of the interests of a wider set of society. But there was a third factor, which I do think is really, really important. And here I'm very influenced by what happened in Britain. And it didn't happen in Germany in the 19th century. It was a disaster. So this is the point. The British elites successively shared power over a period of 100 years. And they did so because at each stage, and there were many stages of this, all combated, all contested, in which finishing with the suffrage of women, because the alternative seemed infinitely worse. It meant the breakdown of civil peace, the breakdown of society, and possibly a real threat to liberty for them too, not just for them too. So they concluded, I have a wonderful quotation about the extension of the franchise to the working class in the middle of the 19th century, where they said, well, we're going to have to do this, but we must make sure that we educate our new masters. Now, that was enlightened. Not, they weren't particularly enlightened, but they were enlightened enough to realize that they had to do this. No doubt the profits of empire helped. And the Germans didn't. They fought very hard to prevent it, and that led to terrible consequences. So my big argument here is that it is possible for elites to be enlightened if they understand the alternatives. Mm-hmm. And so the point I'm making here, if you're an American plutocrat now, you are seeing the prospect of another term of office of Trump, far more radical than the last one. As I point out, they're not going to be safe in this world. Nobody is safe in a world like that. The plutocrats then come to depend on the whims of the autocrat. That's not a very nice place to be. And just if you want to look at a really extreme example of that right now, look at Russia. So the point is, it is possible to be enlightened, and it is possible to realize, just as the Athenian aristocracy realized in the 5th century, that actually sharing power might make you safer, and it's certainly more tolerable society. Now, do I really believe that's going to happen? Well, not that much. But if I look at the world as it is now, I'm not clear what else there is, because it doesn't seem to me that the sort of organized forces of reform exist, with the possible exception, and it's a very important exception, and I don't know where it will end up, and I discuss it very briefly, is we have an exceptionally highly educated young people now. They won't, half of them go to university. They are certainly more educated than their parents would be. They understand, they seem to be more insistent on change. I disagree with a lot of the changes they want, but they're more insistent on change. Maybe they will be the agent of change. And perhaps I should have allowed for that a bit more in my writing. But to me, it's not clear where these changes occur. But I am clear, looking at these historical examples I've given to you, and I think there are quite a few more, that it is possible for elites to decide, or at least important elements of the elite, that there are worse things than sharing power. And the worst thing above all is to have one ruler who dominates utterly. If you're a successful Turkish businessman living under Erdogan is very, very uncomfortable. And I think the same will be true if they live under Trump or Trump-like people into the future. So I hope that this will make a difference. Will it be enough? I have no idea.
I hope you're right. Let me just say that, again, I come from Latin America, where for the longest time, most elites have preferred to live besieged rather than to share power. So who knows?
I'm very surprised that Latin American elites have been so defensive for so long.
Let's try to end on a positive note. Do you see, you know, amidst the very grim landscape that has led you to write this major book, do you see any signs of hope that at least any part of this reform program can be adopted? And when I mean hope, I don't mean it in a starry-eyed way. I mean, do you see any concrete signs of hope of any of this happening anywhere?
Yes, I actually, it seems to me let's just focus on the couple of countries I know best and which were a particular focus, Britain and America. I think, though I don't agree with everything they're doing by any means, the basic logic of what I'm saying is at the heart of the Biden program. That's what they think. Obviously, very difficult, but they did win a majority in the last election and they're doing quite a bit. Some of it I'll disagree with, some of it I'll agree with, but the aim seems to me broadly in these lines. And that shows there's a sort of fight back going on. There are plenty of perfectly sensible places elsewhere which are grappling with this in a sensible way. And I've been very encouraged. It's overwhelmingly probable the next government in Britain will be a Labour government, centre-left again. So the centre-left does seem to be reviving to some degree, beginning to show signs of awareness. We saw this again in the Spanish election just now. The centre-left did much better than many feared. And these extreme right-wing barbarians really did very badly. That was incredibly encouraging to me. It shows that the ultra-right is not always victorious, particularly in multi-party settings, which is an important reform, I believe. And then there's a sort of little thing, but it's also a very big thing. You know, to me, the greatest single thing about democracy, far and away the most important, is that you can get rid of bad leaders without killing anybody. You don't need a civil war. It's a civilized way of doing politics in the most direct way because it prevents the alternative, which is civil war. Well, we in Britain should never have had them as prime minister. We got rid of two dreadful prime ministers who should never have been there, but they went peacefully. They went because they lost the support of their own party in parliament. There wasn't any violence. They did some economic damage, for sure. There's no doubt about that. And the great capacity of democracy to change who's in power when they are discredited without violence was shown. I couldn't do this in China. They will never get rid of Xi. I mean, that's pretty bad. However bad he is, he's going to remain. It seems to me, unless there's a coup, which would possibly be even worse. So it shows there's a limit to what you can get away with. And it is worth remember that though he will never accept that, Trump got beaten pretty soundly in the last election. And I still hope he will be beaten pretty soundly in the next one. So I think there remains life in this great democratic ideal. I think most people, if they're really asked, and they understand the danger, many don't, at least in the countries I know, would rather live in a liberal and democratic society than in a dictatorship. And I think most sensible people realize that dictatorship can only undermine basic social stability. So I think there's hope because it's obviously the best system in the long run for most people, even if it's never perfect. And that's a pretty good basis for hope. And in any case, one has to hope despair is a sin.
I mean, you're preaching to the choir here. You know, I'm a in a way, a minimalist when it comes to democracy. Democracy doesn't guarantee you good government, but it gives you the chance to get rid of a bad government. That, at the very least, that, and that counts for a lot. So, The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism by Martin Wolf, phenomenal book. I encourage our listeners to buy the book, to read it, to think about it, and hopefully, at least for a few of you, to act upon it. Martin, has been a real joy, a pleasure to meet you virtually. I hope to meet you in person at some point. For the time being, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
It was a great pleasure, a wonderful, searching interview.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.